It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Forgive the voice. It's live this week. It wasn't live last week, the show, because things interrupt. You know, I am acutely aware this time of year of time. And there never seems to be enough time to get the things done that I had planned to do in spring. It's just, it's the classic time when you've got to really concentrate to get everything done, and then boom, something like, oh, what do you call that thing? COVID comes up, and you get it, and it knocks you down, and you just have to accept it, and accept that time is rushing by, and that you're not going to get everything you wanted to get done. So we're going to have to talk about that today. We're going to talk a lot about time. Talk about your immediate need to understand time. Listen, if you're on the Gulf Coast, I don't know what you're reading. I don't know where you're getting your information from. I don't know what TV channel or what Facebook nonsense you're reading. But here's the time is right. The time is right for planting. You got to get, you know, it's a really interesting thing. I think most people are used to thinking about cold is the great insurmountable obstacle, and we have to think about, oh gosh, when is it not going to be, when is the last chance that it could possibly be cold? And you better be hoping for that last chance of cold weather, because it's not the cold that's our problem. It's the heat. And the heat is advancing rapidly. It will be too hot for many things very soon. Too hot for cabbages, too hot for broccoli, and soon after that, too hot even for tomatoes. So we have to be thoughtful about time and getting things done as quickly as possible. What is it time for along the Gulf Coast? Well, I can tell you everything. There's almost no reason to delay anything at this point. My goodness, if you're still haven't gotten your tomatoes out, you're a couple of weeks late. You want to do that. You've got to do that as quickly as possible. There's absolutely nothing in the weather forecast, nothing in the deep time, our knowledge of what happens with time, year after year, nothing, none of that suggests that you should delay on your tomatoes. You got to get your beans in. You got to get them sown. It's too late for things like peas and a lot of other things. You can give me a call. If you're going to, and people are going to say, oh, well, gosh, what about my shrubs and my trees? All of that, if you were really conscious of time and you were conscious of how time works on the Gulf Coast, and how seasons work, and how they've worked for a long time, you would have planted those things last fall, but you didn't, so you want to get them in as soon as possible. You want to get them in as soon as possible. And is it time to start seeds now for tomatoes? No. You might as well just wait. But you still have a chance for eggplants. You can still do eggplants. You can still get your okra ready to go. That's all of those things are happening. If you're in North Alabama, you got a little bit of a delay. But, you know, quite honestly, if you've got some sizable tomatoes, given the weather forecast coming up, I would say go ahead and get them out. Even in Huntsville, you might use a wall of water just to give yourself a little bit extra insurance and to make sure that the ground is warm enough. You could wait just a little while on beans, but it's time. It's time to get things out. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. We're going to talk about all the other things that, oh, I'll have to say over and over and over again, like don't cut your citrus back. You can't tell if your citrus is dead. Yeah, just hold on. Hold your horses. We're going to wait on those kinds of things. Don't do that just yet. Wait, wait, wait. Those are the kinds of things you wait on. But planting, it's time to get it done. You know, I'm also thinking about time. It makes me think about time like I think about the cypress. Is it wrong for me to think about the cypress that Ben Raines and a few other folks found right there out in the Gulf of Mexico? And what that cypress meant, those cypress stumps out there in the Gulf of Mexico, it was a big thing about time. It also makes me impatient. It also makes me think, gosh, we really don't have a lot of time. Things are happening pretty fast because those cypress stumps out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, just about on the edge of Dauphin Island, what they tell me is that things not so long ago, just a couple or three, four generations of cypress ago, were very different. We're very different along the Gulf of Mexico, and the Mobile Bay was a valley. It wasn't a big body of water. It was a valley with a river running through the middle of it, and there were forests all along the sides of that valley. And that forest was very much like the kind of forest you expect to see, in the Appalachians. Because at that time, the Appalachians were all tundra, not very long ago. And all of these oaks and hickories and beeches and basswood and elms and ash trees, they were all along the banks of this river in this deep valley. And below that was something called the Delta. The Delta now, many of you know, it's mostly above the causeway. Mostly above the causeway, and it extends about 30 miles. But in those days, the Delta, not so long ago, just three or four generations of cypress ago, the Delta was down there by Dauphin Island, and Dauphin Island was a hill in the middle of a big plain, with lots and lots of longleaf, one would imagine, and shortleaf pine, and lots of other oaks, scattered for 80 miles south of where the coastline is now. And in a matter of decades, in a matter of centuries, that was inundated. As climate changed, as climate does. Happened very quickly, happened very abruptly, changed the way things are, changed how people lived, changed where people lived pretty dramatically. Thinking about time, how much time do we have? It's fun to think about time, fun to think about the amount of time you got left to plant your garden, which isn't much. You got to get it done. Interesting to think about time in the long haul and how things change and how we have to prepare for that. Been thinking about that a lot here lately. Give us a call this morning. I think my voice is going to hold out pretty well. And we're happy to share with you what we know about what you need to be doing right now, how much time you've got left to make your garden work, how much time we've got left to make our world work. We'll talk about those things. Give us a call, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. Save up your questions if you've got questions. Is it too late for me to do this? Is it too early for me to do that? We can talk about that. We'll talk about time this morning. Talk about whether it's time to do what needs to be done to make your gardening work. Vegetables, flowers, shrubs, trees. What are you going to do about your grasses? We'll talk about all that. Just give us a call. 251-343-0106.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. What are you going to do about Dollar Week? You know, it's an interesting thing. There's let's talk about dollar weed real quickly, Michael. It's I have to ask how you're watering. And the reason I have to ask how you're watering is that water is the key ingredient in getting dollar weed to grow and persist. You know, the I just keep remembering, because it worked so well, Mobile Botanical Gardens had a dollar weed problem, or people perceived it was a dollar weed problem. There was dollar weed coming up in the grass, and that's fine, and that was enough to know, and I had to fix it. And so what I did was turn off the irrigation system, and it worked wonders. Let's talk about irrigation, because there's a lot of misconceptions out there about how irrigation works. First off, let's come back to the idea that you live in what is one of the two or three wettest cities in the U.S. And depending on which 20-year period you use, it might be the first wettest or the second wettest or the third wettest. It's a wet city. It's a very wet place. And so you're already getting a lot of rainfall, and that's a problem in and of itself for a lot of weeds. It's a problem for grass, because grass, most of the grasses that we grow actually don't thrive in heavy rainfall environments. They like really well-drained soils, and you could argue we don't really have a grass that's adapted to where we are, and in fact, I would argue that very vehemently. We don't really have a good, great long grass, and maybe there is no single long grass that's going to be a great solution for our climate. But let's be clear, we get a lot of rain, and there is no extended dry period that's predictable. And there were used to be recommendations. I don't know why they came out. They were bogus. They've always been wrong. That grass needs X number of inches per week, or an inch per week. Do you think anybody's actually done that measurement? Do you think there's actually research to back that up? No. And the reason is because you can't predict things like that. It's ridiculous. It's always about how much moisture you've got in your grass, how much moisture there is around the crown of the grass. And when you water every week, you not only are encouraging diseases that damage the grass, you're also encouraging weeds that love excess moisture. And dollar weed is one of those weeds. It's a nice native plant. It loves wet conditions. It thinks that you love it, because you're providing these extra wet conditions. You never allow the soil to dry out. And so the secret to managing your yard is learning that you want to water your yard really well when it needs it. And when it needs it may only be 3 or 4 times a year, particularly once it's established. And in fact, you could argue that most lawns in Mobile will get along fine without ever being watered once they're established. But if you water every week, I don't care how much, if you water every week, I guarantee you're eventually going to get a dollar weed problem. Almost guarantee it. If you allow the lawn to dry out normally, so that it's not so wet in the upper inch of soil, you're going to eliminate that dollar weed, particularly during summer. Now, it may come back during winter. It may come back during excess wet periods, but you're going to really knock it back. And it's that constant moisture that does it. If you live in a place, if you live next to, say, Fowl River or Dog River, and you live along the banks of that river, you're always going to have a problem with dollar weed. It's just going to be an issue in the wetter parts of your yard. Can you live with that? I don't know, except it's always going to be a problem, and if it's not dollar weed, it'll be something else that's going to be associated with extra wet soil. So you need to begin thinking of those areas differently, because those soils are extra wet. So help me out. Let me know if there's anything else I can tell you. There are some products like metasulfuron that are very expensive and that you really can't use in wet areas. Not if you care about Fowl River, not if you care about Dog River. They kind of work. They're very expensive, but I don't think even they will work if you keep watering your lawn. So water it only when it needs it. Call me if you're really interested in how to gauge when a lawn needs water. And this time of year, I don't think it does. I'm reasonably certain it won't. And so you can not water it as long as it's established. If you have a new lawn, we can talk about that. If you have a new lawn, it takes a bit more effort, and you're going to have a bit more problem with dollar weed until you get that lawn established. But that's one of the reasons why I tell you, establish your lawn in November, December. You will have fewer problems. You won't have to water every day. You won't create those weed problems, and you won't create the disease problems if you establish your lawn late in the year like that. Good. All right, let's see. I think you might enjoy this picture. I have a question. I was listening to the rerun of your show yesterday. I was coming back from the Crawfish Festival. Heard a long time about bamboo. Can you cut the stock down while it's green, dig a trench, and put the whole stock in the ground? It will sprout from the joints in the bamboo. Thank you. No. Absolutely not. Under no circumstances will that happen with bamboo. It would be nice if it were that easy, but it won't. Now, you can do that with sugar cane. You can do that with... No, there's some other things out there that you probably don't want to start that way. You probably don't want to get started, but sugarcane comes to mind. It's one of the best ways of doing it starts from the nodes, but it's very different than bamboo. They're both grasses, but they're in different families and they behave very differently, and there's no way to propagate bamboo by cutting a piece of stalk and laying it in a trench. To propagate bamboo, you have to sever the root system, and you have to be careful about that. There are several ways of getting to it. Depends on which kind of bamboo you're looking for as to how much of that root system you may need to sever or how much of it can come, you know, needs to come. But you can't do it with a stalk. You can't do it with a stalk. Let's see here. What else we got? Garden proceeding well, fought for 2 days removing dollar weed in my garden where oak leaf mulch is. Orange trees coming back out well, says Johnny. Should I fertilize orange trees or wait until greenery is more flush? I use granular fertilizer twice per year, which has always worked well. Johnny in Grand Bay. I don't think it will matter that much at this point, as long as they're coming back out well enough. One thing they probably actually won't need it. They don't need an extra dose of fertilizer. I will say that. If you've lost some leaves, that's okay. But I think the extra dose of fertilizer will be wasted, because the plants do need the photosynthesis in order to use it. And there will be about a week or two delay, depending on what it is you're using with a granular fertilizer. Johnny, the one thing I'd say is with those granular fertilizers, be careful not to overuse the phosphorus. Keep the phosphorus low. We'll be back.
I can drive you crazy, yes I can. Well, I can't even make a dish. And I can drive you crazy, yes I can.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. We have to talk about lawns. There is no healthy lawn, period. Lawns are inherently unhealthy. They will always be unhealthy. You will always have to go to extraordinary lengths to create the modern lawn. There are a few things you can do to make it less of a nuisance, to create fewer diseases. One is to let it dry out. And this is not just me. I didn't make this up. This is a lot of people's research. You have to let your lawn dry out. If it stays wet all the time, and if that upper layer right next to the crown where the leaves emerge, if it stays wet, there is abundant research, abundant evidence to show that it's going to encourage diseases, that it's going to encourage insects. So if you're HOA, because boy, they are really smart. They know everything there is to know about gardening, right? Wrong. If your HOA is out there watering 15 minutes a day, they're going to make a bad thing much worse. Because one, it does not develop deep. Your lawn will never develop a deep root system. It means that the water is going to just hit just so deep and then evaporate. And that means you're discouraging a deep root system that's going to make that grass more vulnerable to short droughts. But it's also going to stay wet at the surface, which is going to make your lawn more susceptible to disease and insects. That's the research. That's what it shows. Just saying. It's amazing to me that we talk about freedom and then deliberately give ourselves seed whatever intelligence and reason we have to an HOA that doesn't know. I'm not supposed to say that kind of thing on the air. Just be aware, your HOA doesn't know what it's doing. Any rate, we're thinking about how to do lawns, and what lawns are about. The other thing you can do with your lawn, and I'll just emphasize this because I think we have some new listeners, and our old listeners will know what I'm going to say. Mowing height makes a ton of difference. Every lawn is unhealthy. Every lawn will inevitably be unhealthy, but some lawns will be more unhealthy than others and much harder to manage. And the unhealthiest lawns will be the ones that get watered every day or even every week, and that get mowed too close. You want your lawn to do well. You want to have fewer weeds. You want to have fewer dollar weeds. Don't water every week. And two, mow as high as you can. And you can call me, depending on your lawn, we can talk about it. But basically, for a St. Augustine lawn, if you could mow your St. Augustine at 5 inches high, it would be about as healthy as St. Augustine could possibly be. I didn't make a mistake when I said that. It would actually look just fine at 5 inches high. I can tell you because I used to mow my lawn at 5 inches high, and it was about as healthy as a St. Augustine lawn could be. It's harder to do that with some lawnmowers, but there are ways of getting it done, and that's really good. Centipede, I would definitely keep it up around 3 inches and 4 inches in summer. You can cut it short this time of year a couple of times just to get it to kind of spread a little bit while it's still reasonably healthy. But as summer comes on, centipede's a pretty sorry grass, no question, always will be a sorry grass. But if you raise that mower a little bit, it will be less sorry. It'll be a less sorry grass. Zoysia, same. Particularly if you've got a very short, fine-bladed zoysia, you will be limited in how high you can cut it. But the broader-bladed zoysias that people are planting now, keep them, grow them as high as you can. Grow them as high as you can. I learned to say Gulf of Mexico from Hank Williams. Sorry. That's what it is. It's been part of our life for a long, long time. I grew up along the Gulf. America, the term America is an interesting term. It is, as I said, it's named for an Italian explorer named Amerigo Vespucci. I don't feel any special obligation to honor him. Gulf of Mexico. I think that's what I'll call it. Let's see here. Why are ants taking my garden over? Be dark. You know, Be dark, I have the same question. I want to know why too. It's driving me crazy. We introduced ants. We introduced fire ants, and they have continued to be a special problem for a lot of gardeners. And they're hard to get rid of. They have been taking over the South for a long, long time, and they make it difficult to garden at times. They have some benefits to gardening as well, but all in all, I'd just as soon do without fire ants. I've got the stings on my hands to prove it. Why that's occurring is because we introduced a pest that doesn't have any predators. It doesn't have anything to curb its appetite. It doesn't have anything to curb its reproduction. Unlike a lot of our native ants, which had lots of competition and which actually rarely were a huge issue. So that's the why. The question is, what are we going to do about it? And it's very hard to get rid of fire ants, because if you were to get rid of fire ants in your own yard, which could take a bit of effort and would not be difficult, would not be easy, what's going to happen? They're going to come back from your neighbor's yard with a snap of their fingers. They're going to come back from the areas that you didn't treat with a snap of your fingers. So to be really effective, you have to really control fire ants over a large area. That's how you could control fire ants for a period of maybe a year, maybe a couple of years, if you could get all of your neighbors involved. But you're always going to have fire ants. And so the big thing is, here's the big question. How do you keep those fire ants from being a nuisance in your garden and preventing you from gardening? And that's a difficult question still. But I'm trying various things. We'll see what works. You know, there are a lot of people out there who say that you can put club soda on an ant mound and that it will work to get rid of oxygen in the mound. This is completely bogus. Let me say this, completely made up. It's completely wrong. It's completely false. It has no relationship to reality or to science or to anything else. It's just something, it's the kind of story that people tell on Facebook. Beware of Facebook. So, no, that doesn't work. But sometimes disturbing the ants does work. And I disturb ant mounds as much as possible. You can disturb them with water. You can disturb them with Dom Perignon champagne. You can disturb them whatever way you want to do it, but disturb them. It's pretty expensive if you use the champagne. It's pretty expensive if you use a club soda. Just use water. Use a stick. Just stir those mounds if they're in places that you don't want them. There are some other things that we're using now that can be reasonably effective in a garden when you have fire ants. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about those and how to use them. I'm going to run out of time if I start now, but we'll talk about those as well. But almost inevitably, it involves moving those fire ants around. I'm going to try. There is some evidence. I don't know if it's going to work, and I don't know if it'll work consistently, that you can use orange oil and it will cause the fire ants to move. Most of the techniques that say you're killing the fire ant mound don't work, but I think there are probably ways to get them to move out of your garden. And that's the best we can do. That's the best we can do. I wish we hadn't introduced those fellas. But they're out there, and they're a pain. So we do the best we can. Should I soak my cucumber, okra, squash, and watermelon seeds overnight before I plant them? I don't think so. I wouldn't do that with the cucumbers. I wouldn't do it with squash. I wouldn't do it with watermelons, Don. I might do it with okra. It can certainly help with okra. Is it April 15th? It's not April 15th. We're still going to get a good bit of rainfall. I think the moisture in the ground is pretty good. And pretty good for all of those things. Okra would be the only one I'd be tempted to really soak. I wouldn't do it with the cucumbers, squash, and watermelons. I think there'll be plenty of moisture in the ground for those guys. And I don't see a big advantage in doing that. Now, would it be a wise idea to put your cucumbers in containers, your cucumber seeds in containers, and start them there? Maybe. Maybe. And there are several reasons I would do that with cucumbers. We'll come back. We'll talk about it.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Yeah, let's talk about ants a little bit more in the next hour. We're going to look at some of the various recipes and remedies and see what may work. Nothing seems to work consistently or easily, and I don't want to make it sound like there's a great recipe out there. You're free to try all of the recipes out there, and I think you're going to always find what tends to happen is that the ants come back, even if you're successful in getting a little bit of a delay in those ants. You don't want to use toxic chemicals in your vegetable garden for the ants. That would be a problem. That would be a big problem if you're going to be eating out of your garden. So be careful with that. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. I have a question about Barry. Getting ready to plant some citrus, how far apart should you plant those citrus? I would say, you know, it does depend on what kind of citrus first. There are some citrus that are very upright, like calamondin is fairly upright, and pongkin citrus are fairly upright. Grapefruit, moderately upright. Satsumas are very spreading. They spread broadly, and so they may need a little bit more space. I wouldn't put citrus closer than, say, well, if I were growing satsumas, I would definitely want those satsumas to be about 20 feet apart. And it wouldn't hurt if they were a little farther apart. I think 20 feet's probably sufficient. But about 20 feet apart. Now, if you've got something like a pongkin or oranges, maybe that aren't quite so wide, that aren't so weeping and spreading, then you could plant them a little closer together, but not certainly not closer than 15 feet for most citrus, but somewhere closer to 20, you'll just be a lot safer. You'll be a lot safer. Lemons, Meyer's lemon, thank you, is not going to get as big as some of the others in general, because it'll be probably killed back every few years. And so it may not be, you may not need quite as much space for that one. Barry, am I helping? Tell me what you're going to plant, how many of them you're going to plant, and then we can talk about it. I'm willing to, who is, I'm trying to see who this, oh, it's Bruce. Bruce says, I'm willing to try again to grow black belt asters in Fairhope. Mine grew short and came back shorter the second year. Let me figure out what black belt asters are. And I, you know, it's a common name. I try to be a little bit specific about what they mean, even in some of my older pieces when we talk about what aster is which. I think you may mean, I'm not sure. Where did you get the black belt aster? Did it come from, was it, Was it Cynthia Trachtenpaken's Peyton's, or was it a New England Aster, what's called a New England Aster, which sometimes I've called a Black Belt Aster, because it's very common in the Black Belt. And it's probably very different than the typical New England Aster, now that I am thinking about it. But let me talk about those Asters in particular, in Fairhope. Alabama is a big place. One of the cool things about Alabama is that it has a lot of limestone. It's one of the things that makes Alabama really distinctive, is the limestone in the state. Fairhope does not have a lot of limestone. It is a fairly acid place, and that's okay. It's really neat that it is acidic and that it had supported longleaf, and it had its own suite of asters that were really quite impressive. And if I could have, you know, if I could say, gosh, what could you do really well in Fairhope, I would say, think about the asters, and they're going to be harder to find, that used to dominate the area around Fairhope. They're going to be really hard to find because nothing but houses and Walmart now defines the area around Fairhope. But if you can find some of those native asters, like one of my favorites is a beautiful little aster called Aster concolor, C-O-N-C-O-L-O-R. I'm not sure what the common name, silvery aster. Beautiful little aster, for example, that's quite beautiful. That should do pretty well. That should do pretty well in your yard. So look for the asters that are native there. Those limestone asters will need extra calcium, and usually they like a little more clay in the soil than we actually would have around Fairhope. So there you go. Yeah. Let's see. So who do these houses belong to? Let me look at this. I am gonna say, let's see who that could be. That looks like a crawfish. Is that a crawfish? Is this a wetter area? Because I think we're looking at a crawfish hole. It's a hole in the ground with it looks like it had a chimney on top of it that got the chimney got crushed. But my best guess is that it's a, yeah, there's a little, I can't tell, but I'm thinking it might be a crawfish hole. We'll think about it, particularly with that little orange cap that's right next to it. Huh. Could be a bee, could be something else, but I think it may be a crawfish. Yeah. I'll take a closer look at it. My dry yard, so maybe not a crawfish, unless that happens to be fairly wet. It could be a bee. Could be set one of several kinds of bees. I'm not sure if it's a super dry yard. I'm not sure what exactly that is. So we'll keep looking, see what we can find out. A hole in the ground. Sometimes it can be hard to diagnose a hole in the ground. All right, so we're going to be catching up on some things when we get back. We're going to be looking at ants just a little more carefully. We're going to be talking about some of the treatments you can use for the ants. None of which, be dark, I'll tell you, will be 100% successful. When we come back.
Time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. So our mystery hole, it could be a lot of things. It could be, usually there are a number of insects that make holes in the ground and that will actually put their pupae in the ground. They're usually not that large, but it looks like you might have pulled something out of that hole that made it a little different. So usually when we get ground bees, which are just basically a type of carpenter bee, a blue-black bees, and they're not a problem at all. In fact, they're pretty beneficial. They're some of our most important pollinators. Usually there's multiple holes there. So I don't know. This could be a single bumblebee that's making the hole. I'm not sure which creature it is. It's probably, if you pulled a tube out of the ground and it's solidified like that, it's more than likely a bee. More than likely a bee. Yeah. So let's see here. What else have we got? I did say I was going to talk about ants, which is, oh dear. It's one of those things you'd rather not have to talk about, except I have to think about them a lot. You have to think about them a lot. B-Dark has to think about them too much. So what are we going to do about ants? And they are very, you know, I didn't start it. I didn't start this. This ain't my fault. I didn't bring the ants in. My good friend, my late friend, and mentor, probably one of the best known Alabamians internationally, E.O. Wilson, was one of the first persons to officially describe fire ants here. He described them as Solenopsis richteri, and then realized, oh, Solenopsis invictus came in on their heels. So we brought in two different kinds of fire ants, and those fire ants have probably hybridized to a large degree at this point. What do we do about them? They came in the 30s, 40s on shipments. And they spread pretty quickly, and they have had a pretty devastating effect on the native ant fauna. And that's really important. You know, we think all ants are bad, but in fact, ants are really important. And some of our native ants are really important. They actually carry wildflowers around from one place to another, a hugely important role in moving wildflowers seed from one place to another. In fact, a lot of wildflowers probably wouldn't exist except for native ants. And they play a huge role in many other ways. They're really important, the native ants. But we brought in this invasive called the fire ant, Solenopsis invictus, Solenopsis richteri. And they have spread, and they are a huge issue. They're a huge issue. What do you do about it? So there are, because everybody has to give it, you know, everybody has to give advice. And if you say, I don't know, everybody says, we won't accept that. So they'll go on Facebook and find some kind of crazy new concoction to put on the fire ants. But there are a couple of things that people recommend, and they sometimes work. One is methoprene, and I have read several studies where methoprene, oh God, Esteem, is that the name of the product that it's in? But that it doesn't work that well. sometimes. And it's very sensitive to when it's applied and how it's applied as to whether it makes much difference on the ant populations. Spinosad is another product, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. And I have heard better results from Spinosad. Spinosad, the good thing, methoprene is an interesting product. It's a juvenile growth hormone regulator that only should work on ants and on things like shrimp and other things, so you don't want to use it too near a water body. I'm less convinced about methoprene. Spinosad, I feel better about recommending. I think it has worked in many cases. It's not inexpensive. It ain't cheap. But it's not the most expensive product in the world either, where these pesticides go. So a product containing spinosad, and you can use a bait or you can use a spray, and both may be effective. The spray may be very effective in getting the ants out of your garden area, out of the area where you want to garden, and away from plants. And this is a big deal. This is a major issue. And so I might use that spinosad. If you use the spinosad bait, it will work very slowly, and it should work very slowly. And it will create a little bit of a barrier around your yard as long as you're using it. And you'll probably get tired of using it over because you have to keep applying it. And I don't know how long it will keep working in your yard. But spinosad is another solution. My biggest thing is get the ants moving. Just get them moving out of the places where you need to work, because you're not going to get rid of them. You just won't. And so find a good way to keep them moving. And water is good. Sticks are good. It discourages, particularly this time of year. I think if you can actually begin to bother them this time of the year as they're sort of setting up for summer after winter, I think you might stand a slightly better chance of getting them to move out of your beds. So there you go. You know, it's sort of like saying, how do you stop war? I don't know. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. The ants are here, and they're difficult. And as long as I think even with some of the pests that we brought in, like the head-eating flies, like the forid flies that eat the heads off of ants, that requires that we actually tolerate native ants. And we're not very good about doing that. So, I don't know. I'm not optimistic about us getting rid of fire ants anytime soon. They've been with us a while, and they'll continue. Let's see. I have these weeds in my flower bed. I've been dealing with them for several years. I pull them up, and they keep coming back. I've tried pulling them up, then moving them from the pond straw, sprinkler, and preen weed preventer. They keep coming back. Oh, Lord, it's so nice to see a familiar old friend. It's so nice to see a familiar old friend. Florida betony, David, is what you're looking at. It's Stachys floridanus, native plant. It's one of those plants that loves the fact that we don't pay close attention, and we actually do things to encourage Florida betony. Let's talk about it. It's a really cool plant. And I'm sorry I haven't talked about it more frequently lately. Florida betony. Sorry, had to get some tea. We're going to be back here. We're going to talk about Florida betony. What a cool plant. Stack is four Danis. We're going to talk about it. You'll see it in a different way.
Go on, sweet potato pie. Have you ever seen peaches? Go on, sweet potato pie.
You get plain talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Questions coming. Let me get to this one before we lose track. We're going to talk about a plant called Florida betony. It's got another name, rattlesnake weed, because it has these little tubers that are underground, and it's those tubers are really important. And one of the important things about those tubers is that if you don't poison the plant first, those little tubers are quite delicious. They're quite good. They're quite edible. I would eat them frequently. And in fact, they're very closely related to a delicacy in France called, oh goodness gracious, excuse my French, something like croon. But it is a very delicious root crop. And I don't know what to say. It's quite good. So you can dig it up and you can eat it, as long as you hadn't poisoned the ground first. If you poison the ground first, you don't want to eat it. But it's good. Now let me tell you why you can't get rid of it. This is a very important thing. It does most of its photosynthesis in winter. And then when summer gets here, when people start cleaning their beds out and doing their weeding, and summer gets here early, around late April, early May, and they pull it out, well, it was already going dormant. And so when you just pull the tops off, it doesn't make any difference at all. If you'll dig those roots up in late fall, as the plant is beginning to emerge, if you'll pull those roots up and eat them, just go ahead, cook them. Don't cook them a lot. They don't need a lot of cooking. They're quite good. They're delicate. They're delicious. You can actually use them in salads, raw if you like. But dig them up then, and you'll have an easy time of it. Or, alternatively, you can wear them out by cutting them repeatedly in winter. That's the rule. That's the way it works. If you try to get rid of them this time of year, they will have already put all of their energy into producing a new year of tubers. You can collect those tubers and eat them now if you like. But either way, start the best way if you don't want them is to start in November and early November. There you go, because they're doing most of their photosynthesis over winter. They're really a cool little plant. Love them. Gene, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm early.
So, Gene, you know, I looked up, I thought about your peace lily a lot. I thought about my mom and her peace lily that she kept for years and years, and I want you to keep yours. And Gene, I looked everywhere. I don't think there's any... I would definitely not plant it outside, okay? I think you're going to have to keep it in a pot and put it on a porch, and it will be more likely to bloom if it's getting a little bit of outside air some of the year and a little bit of sunshine during the year. And every now and then you might have to pot it up, but my mom didn't pot hers up that much. I mean, she just kept it there for a number of years. but it wouldn't hurt to put it in size. So, but I don't, it's not going to survive in the ground, Gene, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to leave them in the pot. I've got about 10 of them when my wife died. I got a bunch of peach lilies.
Yeah, that's right.
I got the beautiful plants, but they seem to be, need water pretty regularly.
Yeah, they do use a lot of water depending on the soil in the pot. At some point you might have to change the soil out in the pot. It depends on how much soil is in the pot and how much water they need.
Some of them wilt down quicker than others. I think they don't have much soil in there.
They don't have much soil in them, yeah.
I used to have an old lady live next door to me, and she never cut her backyard, and the leaves stay on the ground. I'd go over and give me a couple of wheelbarrow fools. She'd let me dig up some of that dirt, and that's about the best dirt you could ever have, you know.
It's really great.
But anyway,
well, I wouldn't do that for the peace lily, though. I think I'd get good potting soil because they really aren't going to like a heavy, dense soil.
Yeah.
I would get some good potting soil and pot them up and put them in a slightly larger pot that they're in now.
Yeah. I can't pick up the ones I got now.
All right.
Hey, look here, what did I call you about? That was from 2 weeks ago, I think. But what I call you about was I planted some cabbage and some kale. They're beautiful. But what can you put on there to keep the worms off of things, or can you?
Yeah. So one of the things I'm using, Gene, is netting.
Oh, really?
So I've got some fine netting that I put over it, and there's a couple of kinds of products that I have used, but it just insect netting, and that's really good for, it's really the simple way of dealing with kale and cabbage this time of year. Now, yeah. You're going to have to get rid of those, the ones that are already on there. You're going to have to get rid of the worms that are already on there.
Well, I don't have any yet. I'm trying to keep them off of there.
Ah, good. So if you can find some netting, you can go on, look for insect netting on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And just order some.
How about that netting that you put in the ground to keep stuff from coming up? Will that work?
No, because that'll shade out the plant.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And then the plant won't grow. Yeah, right. So you want something that allows lots of light penetration and that just discourages larger insects. And it's pretty easy to discourage those moths as long as you get that insect netting on there. And I find that's a pretty good way of doing it. Now, can you use other things? Yes, you can use BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is an insect disease that affects caterpillars. And it works well. And they come under products like Thuricide is one name. And it's very safe. The trouble is it works a little bit slow. And it's good if you already have an infestation, but if you can prevent that infestation from occurring, that's the best way of doing it. And just try to find some insect netting, and particularly in spring, it works really well. You'll have to tie the edges down just a little bit, but that's what I would use.
Yeah, okay. Well, that'll work good. But anyway, yeah. I'd call last week and you were off.
I had a bug, Gene. It got, you know, these bugs get you. It's not just the caterpillars. It's the
Maybe we
it's
need
the
to put a net
bugs.
Over you. Huh?
Huh?
Maybe we need
What's
to have
that?
Somebody throw a net over you.
Yeah, that's right. I wish it would work. I wish you could just throw a net over me and solve the problems. I don't know.
Well, anyway, I planted some out there, these big pots that the trees come in, you know, big black pots.
Yeah,
And I used to have some stuff growing in there, and it died off. And I had some mold off tongue I've had for years, and somewhere, you know, it died off. But I got it cleaned all out and put some new stuff in there, and the cabbage and the kale. I don't even like kale. I plant kale because it's pretty. But I'll give it to somebody, whatever. But the plants are beautiful, man. They're really pretty, pretty.
Well, kale is – if I cook kale, it's hard for me to distinguish it from collards.
Really?
They are very similar.
Well, how you just put a little salt in there and
boil. Yeah, I just, in fact, they don't take as much cooking as collards. That's the good part. So, I'm going to have kale for lunch. So, I made, now that you're asking, Gene, I made some white beans. Cooked some white beans. And they're pretty good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of stir fry those white beans with the kale. It's going to be really good.
But we must be going off the air or something.
Well, we're not going off the air for sure. We're just taking a break here, Gene. But I like kale. Try that netting, Gene. I think it'll work well.
All right, I appreciate the information.
All right, Mary, we're going to be back.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Let's see. We got several things going on here. I want to get to all of them. We talked about fire ants. Somebody suggested a product that contains acephate called Surrender. There are a lot of them out there that contain acephate. You definitely don't want to use that on anything you eat. Or even eating close to anything you eat. It is now probably going to be banned by EPA because it is so toxic to humans, and it's a neurotoxin. It basically, I guess you could say, oh, well, I'll use acephate because I won't notice the ants anymore, and you may not. It's a dangerous product, acephate is, and so you don't want to use that on fire ants, and you definitely don't want to use it in your vegetable garden. So just by the way. All right. Let's see what we've got here. We got a caller here from Mary. Is it Mary?
Yes.
Good. Mary,
I'm still
I'm
here.
Listening. How are you? Good.
How are you? Good to hear you're back. I have two questions. One, how do I prune an acacia? I don't know if it's a tree, a bush, a shrub, what you call it. It's leggy like a bamboo. Has beautiful yellow flowers in the fall.
Yeah, how long have you had this, Mary?
A long time.
Yeah, that's amazing. I have not had good experience with acacias, and I'm glad you have. I have never pruned an acacia because I've never had one live long enough to prune one. It's really good. I'm curious as to which one yours is. What do I tell you about pruning it? I wouldn't even know how to begin to prune an acacia. It needs full sun. Is it growing in full sun?
Yes, it is.
Huh.
And it's just leggy and ugly right now.
Yeah. And does it have multiple sprouts from the base?
Yes, it does.
Yes. So here's what I would do. I would prune the leggiest sprout from the base and maybe prune, let's say there's seven sprouts from the base. I'm making that number up, but let's just say there's seven. I would prune two of those, the two leggiest ones, and just prune them all the way to the ground.
Okay, and just leave the rest of the bushes
and leave the rest because they won't be quite as leggy, and then every year go in and prune out the leggiest ones.
When, about what time of year?
Yeah, I'd do it now. there'd be no reason not to do it now, and this would be a fine time to do it, and just do it now.
Do it now. Okay. I won't hold you because I know you have people in line, but one other quick question, I think.
Yes.
When and with what do I fertilize a fig tree?
Yes, leaves. They love leaves. I had a fig tree, and I never fertilized it with anything. I just dumped leaf bags on it, and boy, did it love it, and boy, did it produce like crazy.
They just don't need a lot of leaves.
They don't need a lot of fertilizer. Okay. If you want to throw a little bit of cottonseed meal on those leaves, you can, but I wouldn't even add a lot of fertilizer, because what you're going to get, the problem with figs in our climate is that they produce a ton of leaves, and they grow like crazy. So you don't want to encourage them to keep growing. You want them to actually say, slow down and produce flowers. So just
exactly.
the leaves are the things to do. And that way, and then pruning it every year is really important too.
How do I prune that?
So just like the acacia, go in and look for the tallest, fattest stems at the base and cut them back to the ground. Back to the ground.
Gotcha.
And it's not too late to do that now. Go ahead and do that. And then the other stems, you can cut off about nose height. Just cut them off.
About how high?
About nose height.
Okay.
And I'm guessing, and I'm basing that on my knowledge of your height, which is to say, I have no idea how tall you are. But somewhere between, somewhere around neck high, something that you can reach. And that makes it easy for you to reach so that you can get the figs easily. And prune
before
it so
the birds
that each,
do.
Yeah, before the birds do. And prune it so that each stem, there's a little eye on that stem, and it's a bud. And make sure the bud, just above where you prune it, faces outward, because you don't want it to face inward. You want it to face outward. That'll make it easy to do it. And every year just do that, and that's all you got to do to that fig. But add those leaves. Those leaves just make a ton of difference. So when the live oak starts dropping all those leaves, which it's about time for it to do, just throw those leaves right around your fig.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
All right. I hope you get over your crud like I'm getting over mine.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, Mary. Bye. All right. Vanna, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes. My friend gave me 4 seeds, and I can get more if I like, from her beautiful, wonderful, fragrant lavender wisteria. So I'm wondering, should I put them in potting soil first in a plastic pot and wait till it comes up and then transplant it into the ground? Or should I just dig a fairly good-sized hole in the ground and put potting soil in there mixed with the regular soil and plant them right there?
Oh, boy, Vanna, is this a hard question. First, let me say, Oriental wisteria is a major, you may regret this the rest of your existence. It is very hard to control. It will put up root sprouts 50, 100 feet away from where you plant it, and it will do it rapidly. It will also take many years before it starts blooming. Effectively, after it takes over your yard, will it actually start blooming? And that's got to do with it. It basically spends all of its time running all over creation before it will even think about blooming. Now, that's if you buy a propagated plant. It takes a long time for it to start blooming. The second issue is if you start from seed, you're not going to have a wisteria that looks like the wisteria you got it from. You're going to have a wisteria that looks like a wild wisteria in in Asia, which is not going to have big blooms. It may be less fragrant. It will certainly not have the kind of beautiful color you were looking for. It will take that wisteria about 20 years to bloom. And in the meanwhile, in the meanwhile, you are going to have a huge disaster. Now, how should you trust me about this? Yes.
Oh, yes. I will trust you, Kevin.
Don't do it. Do not do it. Don't do it. So there are some native wisterias that are quite beautiful that aren't quite so difficult. Finding them is hard because we've ceded our lives to Walmart, Home Depot, and Lowe's, and they don't have a clue. But if we can get them at the Mobile Botanical Gardens plant sale in fall, it would be a great thing. I'll certainly encourage John to think about that next year. But the native wisterias are much nicer to deal with, and they bloom much earlier. I can't tell you why they bloom earlier, but they do. I mean, they don't wait 20 years to bloom. And they're just generally much nicer plants to deal with in your yard. But I am just going to tell you, I can't in good conscience tell you to plant that Asian wisteria seed. It would be a disaster for your yard, and you would never see it bloom. I can just about guarantee you will never. Just going to take forever.
Well, this plant that I saw was about between five and 6 feet tall, and her husband had kept it trimmed, and it was just blooming its head off in her backyard.
So mowing around it probably helped. But there are plenty of people who have bad experiences with Asian wisteria, and they might call in to fill us in, just so I'm not left alone giving you this bad news. But it's a difficult plant. It's possible if you have a large enough area that you're mowing around, it may be that you get all the sprouts, and that's okay. But if there's any bed that it can come up in, it will be a marvelous nuisance the rest of your life. It's worse than bamboo. It is worse than bamboo. It is much harder to control.
Are they all Asian?
No, and in fact, there are native wisterias that come from Alabama. At least one species, maybe two species, that come from Alabama, and they're quite beautiful, and the plumes are not always as large. They're not as long as some of the Asian wisterias that have been cultivated for years and years, but they'll be as long or longer than the ones you grow from seeds, and but they're really quite beautiful, and they don't spread as aggressively as the Asian wisteria does. They stay put, and they start blooming earlier. After about 4 or 5 years, you'll have plenty of blooms out of a native wisteria.
Okay. Well, maybe the program at your Mobile Garden Center will get some for next year.
Encourage them and help them out. I don't work there anymore, but I help them out as much as I can, and ask them for, ask them, just send them a message saying, boy, we would love to see some American wisteria, some native wisteria.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, Vanna. Okay, let's see. Oh, gosh. Jim in Georgetown. Vanna, come look at our wisteria and see what kind of monster they can become if left unchecked, even for one season, Jim in Georgetown says. Thank you, Jim. I needed that backup.
Baby, because everything's on the phone.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. No, I don't recommend anything that... There are many fire ant products out there, like Amdro and Surrender and others, that have a very toxic chemical in them that you definitely don't want to use on your garden beds. And that toxic chemical is about to be, acephate is about to be banned. And it's about to be banned because it's such a potent neurotoxin for people. I don't know. Think about it. Is it too late to plant little red potatoes? Yeah, really, it is. I would get those potatoes started on the Gulf Coast much earlier. I think it's really hard to get them. If you're in Huntsville, you still have a little bit of time, but even there, it's getting dodgy. It's going to be too hot. And I don't recommend planting the little red potatoes this late. I would start thinking about sweet potatoes now. This is a good time. Getting the red potatoes started, usually an earlier process along the Gulf Coast, something that happens much, much earlier. David, I'm thinking about you. I am so glad you showed that picture of Stachys floridanus, our nice Florida betony, our rattlesnake weed. I hope it gives you a new way of looking at it, and I hope you got my message about how to control it if you decide to control it. If you haven't poisoned it already, give it a try. Those little rattlesnake roots are really neat, and they're going to be well developed at this point. Let's see. We had a hole in the ground, and we were trying to figure out what the hole in the ground is, and it's a little tricky. I am not absolutely sure. There's a whole series of things. There are lots of bees. There are some bumblebees. If you saw a bumblebee near your hole, then that could be. It could be something like a cicada killer, which is it's a type of wasp. And it will dig holes in the ground and then take cicadas and put those cicada larvae in the ground for its youngins to eat on. Cicada killers are not people killers. They're just kill cicadas, and they're pretty harmless. And it could be, but I think the hole is probably abandoned at this point. My guess is it's not a new hole, but something left over from last year, which makes it a little bit harder. Could have even been a yellow jacket hole. I don't think so, but it could have been. And it's left over from last year. Yeah, good. And what else have we got going on that I haven't gotten to in terms of answering questions this morning? I know, Amy, that I did not get to your question again, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about the research I do. You know, I run a research center, and I think science is about to become something that's very unpopular. I will tell you that we do science there. It's something that we think is pretty important. I will tell you that I am not a research scientist. I wish I had maybe spent my life being a research scientist. What I do is I create the conditions in which other people can do really good research, and then I report on it, and I talk about it, and I try to spread the word on that. And sometimes I know enough to even maybe suggest types of research that can be done there. But we have many researchers, and they're all very good at what they do, and they're doing a lot of interesting things. Amy, one of the coolest things right now, there's so many cool things. I mean, I'll just start here, is that we're finding photosynthesis in the caves. And I'll just let you contemplate that. Alabama is the center of cave diversity in North America, and it's a great place to study caves. Isn't that incredible? Can you believe that? And it is. And so, but one of the things is we're finding photosynthesis going on in the dark parts of caves. Now, if you know anything about photosynthesis, you're saying, what in the world is he talking about? So, Amy, you can ask me next week to explain more about what that means. That's a pretty big deal. It's pretty wild. And it just says there's a lot going on in Alabama we don't know. There's many other things we're studying, Amy. And one of the things I want to emphasize, and I hope I can emphasize it every week, is that because of time, and the changes that have occurred through time, changes in climate, changes in seasons, Alabama has actually been fairly stable through those changes when the rest of the country was not. Alabama has remained a fairly moist place. Alabama has remained a place that was never covered by glaciers, whereas most things north of Washington, D.C. were. And Asheville, North Carolina was tundra and boreal forest, kind of a northern Canada forest. So what that means is we've got all these species down here, and one of the things we're beginning to look at is that, Amy, this is so important. It's things like elm trees, which have been lost. American elms have been lost from the northern tier of states, and it's because they weren't very diverse. But in Alabama, and I'm saying Alabama specifically, it's pretty bizarre, and in some other places in the South, but particularly in Alabama, we have an incredible American elm diversity that seems to be resistant to the diseases that have taken out elms in much of the rest of the country. So we're beginning to do the DNA work to look at what's different about these elms. How do we distinguish the different elms that are here? We've got white ash that's fixing to be affected by disease. White ash made the Louisville Slugger. It's how we hit it out of the park. What a cool thing. And we're about to lose it because we've introduced diseases that are affecting ash trees that are just as bad as some of the fire ants that we've introduced that we can't do anything about. So we're studying that as well. And that's a really interesting thing. We're beginning to understand a little bit about how soil affects what trees grow where. And that's a huge subject that we've got to understand more about, because if the future of our forest, what are the soils that they need to survive? It maybe we can just plant a tree somewhere and say, oh, well, this should do just fine, sort of like that black belt aster that Bruce tried and it didn't do so well in one place because the soils weren't right. How do we figure out what kind of soils and what's living in those soils that makes those trees grow there? All of these things are the things we're researching at the Paint Rock Forest Research Center. That and many, many more. We'll talk about that more in future weeks. And the holes are new this year. I've seen them in the past springs, but in lesser numbers. I'm going with the B theory. Thanks for your input. Yeah, so I do think if you're seeing a lot of holes in one place, more than likely it's bees, it's ground bees, and they're pretty cool. And this is about the time of year that they start showing up in dry soils. Glad we figured that one out. We'll be back next week.